Good evening. As we pay attention to the workings of our mind, we come to recognize that within our human consciousness, we have two motivations, and each one of them affects how each one of them determines how we will live our lives. They are like primal forces, fundamental forces that drive us. They bring us energy, and they bring inspiration to our lives. So the first one that we can recognize is our inherent need to know the truth about life, to know the nature of life. We really want to know it. We're always seeking to know the truth. And this need also includes the desire to live according to that truth. This first motivation is about wanting to have our life be authentic and not to waste our lives, not to live a false life. And this drives us. This is what Suzuki Roshi called our innermost desire, our inmost desire. The need to know the truth about our life. The second motivation, which of course is with us 24 hours a day, is the desire to take care of ourselves in a very practical, everyday way. To take care of ourselves in terms of our survival and our safety, our comforts, our satisfactions and companionship and pleasures and all those things that we think about and try to attain in our ordinary life, in our ordinary lives. And this is the second motivation. We think a lot about the first one. It always comes to mind. And we search for it, the need to know the truth. We search through reading various books and listening to various talks and discussing with each other and maybe writing and reflecting. The first one is always with us in kind of the background, but the second motivation has very immediate energy. Everything we're doing in our life, full of energy. And this second motivation, to take care of our life, very often overwhelms seeking the answer to the first motivation. Because our personal desires are very strong, and it's hard to set them aside. And in addition to that, we become very dependent on the thinking mind. And so we come to expect it. We expect the thinking mind to reveal the essential truth of the first motivation. This is our dilemma. Because this is not possible. The essential truth of our life, what we want to know according to our first motivation, the essential truth of our life can only reveal itself by itself. And so this is why we practice. And as we say over and over many times, that our practice, our spiritual practice, is not intellectual and it is not mental. And this non-emotional effort will help us discover the truth in the same way that everything is expressing the truth without words and without thought. Because our mental activity, as valuable as it is, to help us take care of our life in an everyday sense, this mental activity can isolate us, can isolate the self and its needs, and create ideas of ourself in contrast to the world. Me and it. This is what can happen with too much dependence on our mental capacity. It creates what we call a subject-object split. Me and the rest of the world. And when that happens, when there is this split, when we have too many ideas about ourself, then our life becomes driven only by the second motivation, and we tend to forget about the first motivation. This is a human dilemma, and it's happening more and more. Zen practice is still pretty new in the West, in the U.S., a little over 50 years, and it still brings excitement and inspiration to this culture. 50 years ago, when Suki Roshi had come from Japan, and San Francisco, where people were very excited, and here in our small practice, we were very excited being with him and receiving this new practice. So Zen practice is still something very new for us. And we don't fully understand it yet. We still haven't fully absorbed it. And so for some, it's still like a toy or a plaything. It's cute. It's cool. The Zen Hotel just up on El Camino. What is the name of that company?
Zendesk.
So it's cool, you know. So we are still treating the practice in some way like a toy. Something that will bring personal satisfaction or a chuckle. And we do like the art that the practice has brought forth over the centuries, the calligraphy, the statuary, the aroma of the incense, the stories about Zen teachers and Zen pilgrims. It's all very exciting. But the deeper meaning of our practice is that it can show us a new way. A new way for us in this culture to fulfill our inmost desire. That is, to understand our authentic life and how to live it. Live it. This is big hunger for us. Even as we are so busy working on a second motivation in our everyday life, still we hunger to know the truth. And a practice can help us discover it. So the practice is not, Zen practice is not supposed to, it's not intended to bring excitement. It does. It's not intended to do that. That's not the point. In fact, Suzuki Roshi, when he was still very new in this country, he spoke about avoiding excitement. Don't attach to excitement, he said. Because excitement is, after all, a mental activity, and it cannot satisfy our inmost desire. So he said, don't get too excited. Take it easy. And in very, very pure Zen practice, there is no excitement. But for us, with our continued practice, any kind of initial excitement will transform slowly into quiet inspiration and confidence. So our practice is about satisfying our inmost desire, our first motivation, and understand how to live an authentic life in sometimes difficult circumstances. This is the big question: when some big problem or catastrophe or suffering enters our life, we wonder, how can I live in peace with this? How can I live an authentic life being torn up the way I am with this suffering? Big question. The answer, of course, lies in our practice. But this how to live an authentic life, this how to, is not about learning a set of rules or procedures. This how to live an authentic life, how to means not letting the mind be overwhelmed by its taking care of life's needs. So we emphasize letting our mind become unexcited through this quiet and motionless sitting practice. We simply practice awareness of the breath and practice awareness of the activities of our mind. So in the world of our practice, there is no subject-object, there is no split, there is no isolation, there are no ups and downs created by excitement. Instead, we are left with confidence and the experience of expressing our authentic self. And we feel the presence of all things expressing themselves. As we continue to practice and become more and more comfortable with the workings of our mind, we learn that it's not possible to strive for the truth with mental activity, because mental activity will lead to excitement, to distractions, and to expectations. So we avoid striving, but at the same time, we still make our best effort in our everyday activities. So what is the difference between striving and the effort we make in our practice? It is about our attitude. The difference between striving and making our best effort is in our attitude, which is based on not trying to obtain something for ourself from outside of ourself. That's what's known as striving. And our attitude includes not seeing our practice as some kind of occasional activity that we do when convenient, but we see our practice as a very serious dimension of our life. And it all starts with the willingness to take this posture and let our mind return to quiet. There is a story that illustrates this understanding, a story from China in the 9th century, where all these stories come from. There was a monk, a very, very serious Zen monk in a monastery. He was very zealous in his practice and in his effort. He sat in meditation day and night in this posture. He sat in Zazen day and night. He gave up sleeping and he gave up eating. And of course, over time, he became thinner and thinner, and he became more and more exhausted. Just. And then one day, the abbot, who had been watching him, one day the abbot said to him, you better slow down and take care of your health. And the monk refused. He said, no, I must obtain understanding. I must. I'm not going to let anything get in my way. The abbot said, well, what's your hurry? Why are you rushing? And the monk said, because I have no time to waste. So the abbot then said, how do you know that your enlightenment is running ahead of you and you have to chase it? Maybe it's behind you, and that what you need to do is sit still. Maybe you are running away from it. In other words, no need to strive to catch up to your understanding. So our effort, reflecting the truth of that story, our effort is about simply being on our cushion without expecting or striving for something. Then our true self can express itself without any interference from us. This is the essential truth. Our daily life requires us to work pretty hard to take care of ourselves. Whether we are working today in the high-tech world or we might have been working 300 years ago on the farm, our daily life requires hard work to improve our conditions, to solve our problems, to raise our children, to help each other. It requires great effort, activity, and clear thinking. And it comes with anxieties and excitements. This is a human life. This is our world, and it requires that we make an effort. And this is true for all living creatures. So how can we find the truth of our life? How can we understand our true self if our mind must always be busy? This is our big question. Well, we are fortunate to have this practice handed down to us over so many centuries. And we should be grateful for it and continue it. And little by little experience the inherent calmness of our mind, which is too often overlooked or obscured by excitement. So there's no need to do anything special. It looks special. No need to do anything special. At first, our practice looks like something special. Looks like we are doing something very special. But that is when it still has the appearance of a toy, over time and little by little, our practice becomes very ordinary. And we just simply continue to practice on our cushion. And in the activities every day, without expectation. This is how we let our true nature reveal itself. We human beings are oriented towards obtaining, striving for happiness. We're always striving for happiness. But we can never catch up with it. And that's because it is not outside of ourself. It's always present. Let's let it catch up with us. Are there any questions tonight? Anybody have a question? Yes, please.
Excellent lecture, thank you. You were talking about the difference between the, the rational mind and the logical mind, trying to understand. And I was thinking about all of the reading that I've done on Zen and how difficult I find it at times and frustrating even at times. And I guess as you were speaking, it kind of resonated that I'm using my logical mind to try to break through and try to gain some, I guess, encouragement or understanding. But that's what I have available to me, in a sense. I mean, that's the information that I have. So there seems to be a paradox there. That I'm trying to use a logical mind to find the truth, and yet the logical mind is getting in the way of finding the truth, but that's where the information is. And so I guess that's a question and a statement at the same time.
But is that the only thing you have available to you?
No, certainly not.
Oh.
Certainly not. Yeah.
What else do you have? What else do you have?
You know, practice and being here and sitting.
But still you fall back on the thinking mind. Oh. Do you still feel that that's the best way to go?
No, I wouldn't say it's the best way. It's a way.
Oh.
It's a set of tools, I guess. And there's I guess there's a certain irony there that there's so much written about Zen. I think anybody who practices picks up books and tries to understand them. Yeah. That doesn't seem to be an effective way to really gain that insight.
That's right. But it's hard to break old habits. When we recognize the futility of something that we have been doing for so long that is not producing the desired result, when we feel that futility, then we may become interested in trying to find another way. And that's all part of the process of our, what we learn when we practice. The way the mind works, the stubbornness of the mind, the discoveries that the mind can make. It's all part of the practice, all part of our experience. And it does require patience when it doesn't look like there's any kind of progress. And when we finally give up the idea of progress, then we no longer even need patience. Because there we are. Thank you. Yes, please.
To get to the point of nothingness, you need to sit and mull over, I guess, your shadows and inner turmoil. And I would say it's a process to get to nothingness. But at the same time, do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so.
There are still steps, but in scriptures, Zen is portrayed as if it is always there. But there's no immediate way of getting there. It takes time.
An observation, a feeling. Yeah. Have you been practicing for very long?
I would say so, but not exactly. I don't know, my practices aren't all just Zen practices.
Have you been sitting for a long time?
I've been doing multiple things. Yeah.
Pick out one thing and stick with it. Don't jump around too much. Stick with one thing and some of the confusion will drop away. Find a resting place in your practice. Sure. If you go from practice to practice to practice, your mind will always be saying, is this one better than that one? Or maybe I should try that one? And you're always comparing. So to get out of that trap, just pick one, stay with it. And that'll help quiet your mind. It's okay to be confused. It's okay to wonder and to have these questions. It's great, actually. it does take time so that we can learn from our effort.
But what if a part of that learning is to experience all these different methods of that will allow us to expand ourselves?
When will it end? How many do you need?
You just need to eventually find what works best for you.
Okay. Find one that feels right and stay with it. If you jump around in your various practices, it means your mind is always jumping around. So sit down, be quiet. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Les. Great talk. Just kind of building on this theme, I think it feels like that search for kind of the truth that you mentioned is there's a way to misinterpret it as in trying to acquire something, right? Trying to somehow contain that truth with the thinking mind, and that's, I think, a fallacy, right? That's probably impossible to achieve, which I think is maybe something that you've kind of pointed to when you were in your talk. It's also just an observation that I found interesting is that to the point of separating between our awareness and what the mind may be telling us to do, there's difference between, like, we don't have to, we could act independently of what the mind is saying. And I think what that story that you mentioned about the monk trying to find the truth and contain it is kind of a good illustration of the fact that what he's looking for is already here. It's kind of just looking in a sort of with the wrong tool or in the wrong place. So I just wanted to share.
Okay, thank you. Yes, please. Sharmila.
I was thinking about the two motivations you were saying for living. One is, the first one is to be able to live a true life, peaceful life, and the second one is try as much as possible to be in comfort, to be able to do everything to live the life. The first one, in order to do the second one so much, many times, as you mentioned, that we forget the first one, that we wanted to live the true life, that is truly how do you want to live the life, how you want your life to be. I think I was just thinking about that so much that, you know, now many times we have all this, I don't know what to call it, do's, don'ts. Like, for example, if you're in a family, the father says, this is a true way of living life. So, you are my son. This is how it should be. So, it becomes a family tradition, you know. You're telling her that you have to find one that suits you the best practice, ritual, or belief, or way. So, what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of pressures from relationships that say, if you don't do, if my true way of living life is not yours, none of my friend, or you're not my so relative. How do you overcome that pressure and follow the first motivation? That's what is that's what makes it difficult when you don't want to separate yourself from the world, but you want to live with the world. I'm trying to see why the first one is always missed. How do you overcome that?
Different for everybody, because we all have different circumstances. But it starts with the feeling that there is that first motivation. Yes, I really need to go there. I really need to understand that. And then we have to find some way in the midst of number two, to go there. And each one of us has to work that out. Each one of us has our own journey to get there. But of course, without the inspiration or the insight or the sense that it's there, then we just go round and round in our daily life. What I mean is when we feel inspired, we will find a way. Thank you. Yes, Anna.
I understand why excitement is something you don't want to chase after, and not setting goals or having expectations in practice. It's not for merit badges, instead. But with so many distractions, it seems often you need something to keep attention and right effort at times. Maybe it's inspiration, but, or is there another word, like, is it just curiosity, to keep curiosity about the world, or to just keep beginner's mind about our own minds and the world and how it works? If not excitement, then what?
You know, it's okay to be excited. Just we shouldn't chase after it. It's okay to be excited, but we should always have the beginner's mind that says, okay, what's next? What's next? This excitement, oh, that's good. What's next? If we stay attached to the excitement, we won't have that beginner's mind that's ready for what's next. We'll always stay in the past with the exciting thing. This is our problem. So what's next?